Hello, I'm Sarah Crown, and welcome to the final Haycast of 2009. Over the last 10 days, we've brought you the best of the festival, from A.C. Grayling to Marcus Zusak, with foodies, historians, archbishops, poets, playwrights, philosophers, economists, politicians, and comedians in between. In this finale programme, Zan Brooks discusses cosmic war with Reza Aslan, John Crace offers his final take on the festival's stock characters, and we delve into Darwin's lesser-known writings on earthworms, barnacles, and human emotions with the help of his great-great-granddaughter.
My name's Sarah Waters, and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast. The book that changed the course of my life, I can say very definitely, is Wideacre by Philippa Gregory. It's a fantastic historical novel that really got me thinking about historical fiction way before I thought of writing it myself, thinking about what it can do and how wonderfully political it can be, as well as being fantastically melodramatic.
Hiroko Ashraf watched the patch of brightness slide across the dining table towards her son Reza, whose attention was firmly fixed on the crossword his mother had set for him. The sunlight bumped up against Reza's arm, which was curled around the crossword in the defensive posture of the smartest boy in class who is accustomed to everyone around trying to copy answers from his exam papers. Its gentle nudging failing to convince Reza to move his arm, the sunlight crept up onto his shoulder, from where it could peep down at the grid with its Japanese and Urdu clues and German and English solutions. Hiroko blinked once, twice, and the image was gone. In place of the young boy whose two chief delights were multilingual crosswords and stories told by his mother in which everything familiar, birds, furniture, sunlight, crumbs, everything, acquired character and role, there was a 16-year-old, tracing his finger over pictures from glossy magazines advertising the various electronic gadgets his cousin in the Gulf claimed to own. "Doesn't he own a camera?" Sajjad had said. "Why can't he send you photographs of his fancy VCR and his fancy answering machine and his fancy car instead of clippings from magazines you can buy in Urdu Bazaar? God knows if he's even left the country. He's Iqbal's son, after all."
Carmela Shamsi reading from her Orange shortlisted novel Burnt Shadows, and I'm here with her in the Guardian yurt. Carmela, this is a novel that begins in Nagasaki on the morning of the atomic bomb and follows the paths of two families from there to Delhi, on to Pakistan, as we've just heard, and finally to Afghanistan and New York in the wake of the attacks on the Twin Towers. Carmela, it felt to me as I was reading it almost like I was reading a 19th century novel in terms of its scope and the way in which it follows the paths of these two families across continents, generations. And was that a model that you were conscious of when you were writing it?
It wasn't exactly a model, in as much as I didn't really know what I was doing when I set off. I do really enjoy those kind of tales, and I think there's a lot of space for them in the 21st century, and that there's a lot of space for telling the story that doesn't just say here's this one moment in time that is disconnected from everything else, but to really talk about connections. And so really I was thinking more from a historical point of view, that I wanted to make connections across 60 years. And part of that came from the fact that, you know, when a lot of people, when there's a conversation about 9/11 and the war on terror, there's a sort of assumption as if it all started in 2001. And I really wanted to go back and make deeper connections in a history that went back away. And the only way I knew of doing that was to tell the story that started much further back and then moved forward.
Your characters move around the globe. Did it feel contrived at any point at all? Did you have to contrive coincidences, or did the history carry them forward?
The history very much carried them forward, because I was following the characters and the characters were taking me to certain places and moments in time. Obviously you have to do plotting, and to some people that might be synonymous with contrivance and coincidence, but it always seems to me that there's so much more coincidence in the world than anything ever thrown up by fiction. And if you can just write the character and situations compellingly enough, people will follow along. So there was a point near the end where I was aware it's coming to an ending, and so there has to be a certain kind of tying up that doesn't happen necessarily in real life. But I imagined a very different kind of tying up, so I had one ending in mind, and I was about three chapters away from that ending, and I wrote the end of that chapter, and I thought, this is the end of the novel. So the more contrived ending that I had in mind, actually, which I can now think of as a contrived ending, I never, in fact, wrote.
Yes, because it stops. I don't want to give away anything for those people who haven't read the novel yet, but it stops like someone taking a breath in the mid. It doesn't feel like the end of a story in the way that, you know, history doesn't end. Mm. Having written the novel now, did you feel that the forces that are driving people's lives, your characters' lives, were individual forces, you know, whom one falls in love with? Or was it the story that's going on outside your door, you know, the bigger historical forces that really form people?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that happens if you grow up in Pakistan, as I did, is that you don't really have an idea of that separation. History and politics is not outside your door, it's in your living room. Mm. You know, one of my early memories is at the age of 5 going to visit an uncle who was under house arrest by the military government. And so, you know, and that's not really unusual if you're growing up in Pakistan, that there's somehow or the other some political event is very much entwined with personal lives. And political events meant that there were certain days when school was closed and there were, you know, exams were cancelled. And so even sort of the everyday stuff of childhood was filtered through this lens of what is going on in this political world. Mm. And it very much became part of the personal landscape. And so for my characters as well, it's, I think, the same thing. There is the stuff of just individuals encountering other individuals, but it's always happening in a very specific place and time where there are certain historical forces at play, and those forces are not separate from the kind of decisions and freedoms you have and can make. And so I wanted that to come through in the novel.
And of course you're shortlisted for the Orange Prize, which is announced next week. How are you feeling about that?
Very nice. It's a very good list. And of course, to be on a list with someone like Marilynne Robinson, who, you know, Housekeeping to me is one of the great novels ever. It's sort of a miracle of a book. And so just to be in that kind of company is phenomenal. And of course, you know, there are so many books published every year that something like The Orange makes a big difference just in terms of getting people to notice yours. So at that very sort of practical level of, I want people to pick up my book, it makes a big difference.
Kamala, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you, Sarah.
Good luck next week.
Thank you.
My name is Kate Adey, and my guilty reading pleasure is Terry Pratchett.
John Crace here, hovering by the deck chairs at lunchtime now that the festival's well underway. And the out-of-townies are here in force. You can tell them a mile off. There's Melissa, decked out in her brand new designer wellies that she picked up for next to nothing in Islington last weekend. Just one of the thousands of out-of-townies prepared for anything the notorious hay weather can throw at her. Isn't this amusing? I keep hearing her shriek as unpleasant white foam bubbles up from the green matting. She phones her hairdresser back in London to make sure her appointment for Monday is still in the diary, and then launches herself bravely into the elements and nods passionately in agreement during a brave talk on change meta fiction in feminist iconography. Emotionally and physically wrung out by the depth of her identification with change, she gravitates towards the cafe for spiritual and nutritional renewal. She looks around doubtfully. The food might be organic, but it looks awfully, well, rough and ready. Still, she doesn't want to appear a snob, so she risks a goat's cheese salad. At the very least, it'll help her lose weight. And on the upside, she'll be back in Notting Hill next week, and she's got a hot date.
My name's Giles Foden, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast. For me, the book that changed the course of my life was Meeting the British by the Northern Irish poet Paul Muldoon. And really, I think he showed me how history and politics could be brought into alignment with one's own creative and aesthetic ambitions. So that book really sort of opened my eyes to what literature could do.
Hello, I'm Zan Brooks. Reza Aslan's first book, No God But God, was translated into 13 languages and was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. His new work, How to Win a Cosmic War, examines the relationship between radical Islam and the war on terror, two ideologies that are perhaps not as opposed as some have claimed. Reza Aslan, I'm remembering that on September the 12th, 2001, the Guardian's front page headline read, A Declaration of War. Now, on reading your book, I'm suddenly made aware that this was a dangerously flawed premise. How so?
Well, as I say, it wasn't so much a declaration of war as it was an invitation to a war already in progress, but not a real war, a war of the imagination. We have to understand that Al-Qaeda is fighting what I call a cosmic war, a war that is not really taking place on this earth, but in fact is a battle between the cosmic forces of good and evil, and they see themselves as just merely pawns in God's hands. And particularly when it came to the attacks of September 11th, this was an attempt to sort of draw the United States into precisely the same kind of cosmic contest. And unfortunately, it was an invitation that most Americans were more than happy to accept.
If, as you argue, the only way to win a cosmic war is not to fight it in the first place, is there a danger that in engaging as we did and as we sort of still are to some degree, that it becomes the geopolitical reality, that it takes on a momentum of its own?
Well, absolutely. You know, by adopting the same religiously polarizing language as the jihadists, by accepting the same Manichaean worldview, by talking, you know, in these terms of good and evil and civilizational clashes, we validated their worldview. We essentially legitimized the way that they understood this conflict. And to put it in the simplest terms, we were fighting this war on their terms. So when I say that the only way to win this kind of conflict is to refuse to fight in one, what I mean is that we have to strip these wars, these conflicts, of their religious connotations. We have to focus on the material matters that are at stake, because the thing about a cosmic war is that you just can't win it. It goes on forever.
If you're saying that the jihadists are fighting a cosmic war, what exactly are they fighting for? What are their demands? What are their goals?
Their goals are nothing less than global transformation. What they want to do is they want to rid the world of all nation states. They want to erase all borders and national boundaries. They want to reconstitute the globe as a single space under their control. This is what they mean when they say the caliphate. They're a utopian movement in sort of the purest sense of that word. And in many ways, by taking their goals seriously, because quite frankly, these are insane goals, once again, we're sort of validating their ideas. They rarely talk about their goals. They rarely talk about their agenda. We do much more than they do. They have no conception of victory except for these sort of airy notions of ridding the world of evil. And so as such, we have to understand that while they do have a lot of grievances, and they use those grievances in an ingenious way to rally people to their cause, they have no plan. They have no policy. They have no agenda. There's no social program that they're trying to enact. The way that they talk about these goals are in these abstract notions of good battling evil, etc.
You make the case in both of your books that Islam itself is constantly evolving and adapting, and that what we are witnessing now is essentially the Islamic Reformation, which implies that global jihadism is little more than a kind of desperate spasm on the margins of that. Is that accurate? And if so, is there a risk that that's kind of downplaying the threat?
No, it's quite the contrary. Jihadism is the inevitable consequence of the Islamic Reformation. In fact, in many ways, the jihadists represent the poster children of the Reformation process, because really what Reformation means is it's about the individualization of a faith. And truly, the most individualistic, almost militantly individualistic version of Islam is the one offered by Osama bin Laden, because this is a version of Islam that's completely unbound to any kind of tradition. It has no respect for Islamic law or clerical precedents. As a matter of fact, it defines itself in direct opposition to the traditional religious authorities of Islam. And as such, it is sort of quintessentially reformist. That's the thing that we have to understand about these terms like Reformation, is that there is no value judgment. Reformations aren't either good or bad, they just are. And as we know from the Christian Reformation, when you say the authority to define a faith rests not in the hands of the institutional authorities, but in the hands of individuals, well, you're opening up a whole can of worms, aren't you? So that anyone with any kind of agenda or ideology, be it positive or negative, now is empowered by his sort of radically individualistic interpretation of religion to create these new ideas. You know, I've gone so far as to say, you know, 100 years from now, maybe 200 years from now, we may look back on Osama bin Laden and see him not just as, you know, a murderer, but as perhaps, you know, the Martin Luther of the Islamic Reformation, a man who pushed the principle of religious individualism to its terrifying limits.
It's very interesting that you say that, because on reading the book, I saw this as essentially a hopeful book. It's an optimistic book. And the suggestion towards the end is that we are perhaps drawing to the end of this cosmic war, or there's the chance for an armistice.
I think so. I think a lot of it, honestly, has to do with the change in administration in the United States, because it takes two to fight a cosmic war. And the one thing that I can say about the Obama administration in the brief time that it's been in power is that they just refuse to be engaged in this. I've found it quite humorous, actually, the way in which these Al-Qaeda ideologues have been grasping at straws, trying to figure out a way to talk to Obama. They knew how to talk to Bush. It was easy because they spoke the same language. Obama refuses to play along. There is no response to an American president named Barack Hussein Obama who can say with confidence, my father was a Muslim. I lived in a Muslim country. I have Muslims in my family. I know what Islam is. I'm not going to play this game anymore. And so they've been reduced to making these absurd racist comments about the president that have backfired, if anything. So I do feel hopeful in that regard. However, to truly deal with this movement, it's going to take more than words. It's going to take a fundamental shift in American foreign policy. We must address the grievances that fuel the jihadist movement. That's how you defeat any movement. You can't fight a movement with guns and bombs. The way that you fight a movement is you make the movement irrelevant. And the way you make a movement irrelevant is that you co-opt the issues, the grievances that the movement uses in order to rally people to its cause.
Reza Raslan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This year, as you'll no doubt have noticed, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of one of the world's most influential and original thinkers, Charles Darwin. The Origin of Species transformed our understanding of evolution and our place in the world, but Darwin was an author as well as a scientist. We asked poet Ruth Padell, scientist Steve Jones, and Cambridge University's Gillian Beer to tell us what his written legacy reveals about the man himself.
My name's Ruth Padell, and I'm one of 72 great-great-grandchildren of Charles Darwin. Anybody who really wants to get to know the writings of Charles Darwin, do start with The Voyage of the Beagle, because it took the public imagination at once. He wanted to write freshly and vividly and personally about what he'd seen, and also, of course, scientifically.
On our return, we overtook a party of about 20 young black girls dressed in most excellent taste, their black skins and snow-white linen being set off by their coloured turbans and large shawls. As soon as we approached near, they suddenly all turned round and, covering the path with their shawls, sung with great energy a wild song, beating time with their hands upon their legs. We threw them some vintems, which were received with screams of laughter, and we left them, redoubling the noise of their song.
My name's Gillian Beer. Darwin first of all wrote The Voyage of the Beagle, and I think that's the thing that established him in the public's mind as an excellent observer, a wonderfully, ravishingly exploratory young man.
My name is Steve Jones. I think Darwin altogether is said to have written about 6 million words. We know of 14,000 letters. Darwin is, of course, most famous for having written The Origin of Species. And in some ways, that's unfortunate, because he wrote 19 books altogether. The Origin of Species does tower above them all, there's no question. But if you got rid of it, he'd still be famous. At least he'd be famous among biologists. I think one of his books is an enduring work of literature. and that's The Voyage of the Beagle. That, without question, is the best travel book ever written. He wrote books about barnacles, he wrote books about carnivorous plants, he wrote books, an amazing book about the expression of the emotions in man and other animals, and almost as amazing a book about earthworms, that was his last book. And somebody who can make earthworms gripping deserves an accolade as an author. Who could possibly care about earthworms, the world's most boring subject? Earthworms form politics. Darwin was the first to show that.
Archaeologists ought to be grateful to worms, as they protect and preserve for an indefinitely long period every object not liable to decay, which is dropped on the surface of the land by burying it beneath their castings. It is probable that many monoliths and some old walls have fallen down from having been undermined by worms.
He engages with travel around the world, a major new theory of the history of the world in The Origin of Species, and then in The Descent of Man he comes right out and talks about how we have come to be as we are.
His writing style is wonderful. I think, as a classicist, I think it was deeply affected by studying Greek and Latin. It's nicely cadenced and very vivid with lovely images. He says things, for instance, like there is, you know, the bright tangle, the bright surface. There's violence under the bright surface.
His style is a very interesting mixture of, at times, a quite rapturous description. His children used to tease him and say that when he described a barnacle, it sounded as though he was doing an advertisement for it. And at the same time, a close observation which misses no detail of the thing being described. He thought himself that he had to write because he couldn't draw. Most botanical writers of the time could do very intricate pictures, but he said he could not do that. So he was driven to refining description. You'll get him describing a beetle, and he'll give you exquisitely precise adjectives to tell you what this peculiar beetle is like. The other thing he does, of course, is to call in other people's observations. So he'll have my good friend Mr. So-and-so tells me, or he'll have his children, and that will go into the expression of the emotions. Always this intimacy in his style, even when it's the most challenging and radical ideas that he's putting forward. La, la.
Bahia or San Salvador, Brazil, February the 29th, 1832. The day has passed delightfully. Delight itself, however, is a weak term to express the feelings of a naturalist who for the first time has been wandering by himself in a Brazilian forest. Among the multitude of striking objects, the general luxuriance of the vegetation bears away the victory. The elegance of the grasses, the novelty of the parasitical plants, the beauty of the flowers, the glossy green of the foliage, all tend to this end.
I think what the style tells us about him as a man is that he's somebody who engaged very closely with the people around him. He sees, I think, almost everything as worth thinking about. In Kent, he apparently is living a very sedentary, domestic life, but he's able, from the materials of his garden and greenhouse and the woods around, to find resources for thinking more and more radical thoughts.
In the last year or so of his life, he wrote an autobiography which he only aimed to his children, his family, but it was published. It's very touching. He talks about his life and how happy he'd been. He scarcely mentions the fact that he'd been severely ill for 50 years, which he had been. He talks about how hurt and upset he'd been by the death of his young daughter. And that really gives you an insight into the way he thought. Darwin describes himself in the autobiography as a man of enlarged curiosity. And that really sums him up.
When he was young, he loved poetry. At school, he read Byron. And he also loved the historical plays, particularly the historical plays of Shakespeare. On the Beagle, he took Milton with him, and he loved Paradise Lost. When he sees a lot of phosphorescence in the sea, he says, nobody could look at this, he says, without remembering Milton. Milton is his constant reference, and he used to slip it in his pocket when he went on land expeditions on the Beagle. But as he went on, He felt that his mind had become hardened to poetry. He said at one point, "My mind has become just a machine for grinding laws out of minute particulars and facts."
I suppose the thing that's striking about The Origin is that it draws on all the writers of its own time. It's a work that sets out to be read at large by any intelligent reader. It doesn't use maths, it uses metaphor, always exploring ways of communicating to a reader who hasn't shared these thoughts before. I think that's what's so striking about it. And it tells a wonderful story, a new story about the history of the world, one that goes back way before humankind and gives us a little place in it. But we aren't central anymore, and that's a very disturbing story.
Well, that's it from me. Thanks for listening, and until next year, goodbye from Hay. The Haycasts were produced by Francesca Panetta, Lucy Greenwell, and Ian Chambers. Music was by Kev Hopper.